Okay, so today is July the 11th, 2016. I'm Carrie Klein here with Michael Klein. And would you say my name is and introduce yourself?
Yeah, my name is Ann Martin, and I'm a native of Concord, Massachusetts.
Great. And your date of birth for some perspective?
My date of birth is 12th of June, 1958.
Okay. Well, why don't you start by telling us about your people and where you were raised?
Well, I've finally learned my family history over the recent years, and my father's forefather or people actually were part of the family that organized and sailed on the Mayflower. I never knew that when I was a kid. I found that out because of a painting my parents gave me. I looked up the history of the painting, and my great-great-great-great-grandfather ran away to sea when he was a little boy, and ended up becoming a clipper ship captain in the 1800s. And his name was Captain Skitty, and he had been orphaned as a boy, and he was originally a tailor, and that's where the Taylor family from the Mayflower. And he became a Skitty. He took his new family's His mother remarried, and he took his new father's name, so he became a Skitty.
S-K-I-D-D-Y.
And Captain Skitty's, going to the rowing, after all my rowing was over, I became invited to be in the Hall of Fame for rowing. And the Hall of Fame for rowing was held at the Mystic Seaport. And I had received the painting from my parents, and it was a painting of a boat at sea painted by a French watercolor painter. I'm going to forget the guy's name. In the 1800s, watercolors of boats were painted for insurance purposes. There were no cameras. And so they would do a sketch of the boat, and they would write assurance, that means insurance in French. And it was the Roux brothers of Marseille. They were the ones who were really doing this. A big family of Roux brothers. There are lots of brothers, uncles, and everything like that. And they are all doing this. But every once in a while, they painted a serious painting of a ship at sea. And this is the painting of a ship at sea my parents gave me. And my sister Betsy told me it was worth a lot of money because it was a Roux. So we took it to the valuation agent. And they said, oh, it's got a lot of mildew. It's probably worth about $5,000. And my sister thought, oh, that's terrible. I thought, great. My parents gave this to me. I don't want the rest of my family members thinking I ran away with something that was worth a lot of money. Anyway, I can restore it. So I took it to, I live in England. I took it to the Norwich, where the boat building center of England. And I thought a painting restorer there would know about boat paintings. And the painting was in good shape. He would reframe it, and that I should look up the history of the boat, of the painting, and then I should write up the history of the painting and put it and tape it to the back of the painting so that if I gave it to my children or gave it away to someone, they would know the history of the painting. And so I tried to find out what the painting was about, was of. And I find it is a, my sister said, my sister who knows everything, she said, it was a Roux painting where the Roux brother who painted it, instead of painting a ship for assurance, painted a boat at sea, only he never went to sea. So where did he get his sketch? It's because the captains in those days had to know how to draw maps because they made money as captains by driving the boat, steering the boat with its good load of goods to from you know A to B, but also chartering place, you know, drawing maps. They were surveyors. They would draw maps. They would earn money that way, too. And once you just start drawing maps in the 1800s, you also become very good at drawing. And he drew pictures of boats at sea when he was at sea, you know, real life from a storm. And then he would sell the picture to the Roux brothers, who would do a painting. So I never knew that when I was a kid growing up. I didn't really care about that stuff. But after everything that happened to my family, they gave me the painting. Well, I wanted to know. So now I know about the Taylor family and the Cushmans and the Mayflower. And now my sister, who knows everything, said, "Yeah, and those Taylors, they were some dark side of them as well." And Aunt Alice told my sister Betsy that the Taylors you had to watch out for. So.
And that's Taylor, like a suit of clothes.
T-A-Y? No, T-A-Y-L-O-R.
T-A-Y.
It's just the family that, you know, that who that was related very closely with not with organizing the Mayflower. And some of them sailed on them, the Cushmans and the Taylors. I found this out because I was researching this painting. Some other people must know that as well. But I only recently found out anything about this, including that Skiddy was actually a tailor in the beginning. So anyway, that was part of my history, so I wanted to get that out on the table.
Yeah, well, move us through the ages to get to you then.
So boating is obviously in our history, and my father's mother's side as well, and I won't go into that, but when I grew up here in Concord, I wasn't on the school field hockey team or anything like that, or the basketball team. We had teams at school. I didn't really like organized sports, but I did hiking and skiing, downhill skiing at Sugarloaf, things like that I really liked. And we had a donkey and some ponies. So when I was a sophomore at Concord Carlisle High School, I misbehaved a lot, and I got in trouble at gym. I actually flunked gym, and the gym teacher one day told me that I had done something wrong, and I had to run in circles around inside the gym. This was in one of the old gym buildings near what used to be the Emerson, near the library, near the Concord Library. They used to have a gym there. I don't think they have that there anymore. It was in there, and they told me I had to run around and around the edge of the gym, the whole gym session. The lady thought that would be punishment for me. Wow, I never knew I could run, but I could run great. You know, I loved it. It was great. And so I remember that as thinking, gosh, you know, that doesn't make any sense. She's punishing me for something that actually, wow, I really like this. And then after that, my parents realized that my parents wanted me to have the best education I could. And they saw that I was just, friends with at school, where, you know, we used to hitchhike into Harvard Square instead of go to classes, things like that. I thought I'd be better off if they sort of changed my environment. So off I went to Phillips Exeter Academy, and we had to do sports there. And I took aquatics when I first got there. It wasn't varsity swimming. It wasn't junior varsity swimming. It wasn't club swimming. It was, you know, the fourth level down swimming. In the old pool, they had two pools. They had a new pool and the old pool. The old pool was where the character in A Separate Piece beat the school record. And
character in
A Separate Piece by Jonathan Knowles. We read that when we went to Exeter, of course. And I'm not sure I'd read the book yet, but I was in that pool. And I was a smoker. And the teacher said that one of the things we did was we played games and everything. And we never had to swim laps. Because, look, they had kids who didn't want to go to gym. And one day they had us do this exercise where you had to weight at the bottom of the pool, like halfway down the pool. You go dive down, swim underwater, pick up the weight, dive back. And gradually put the weight further and further and further and further until it was at the very end of the deep end of the pool. And I was the only one who could swim over there, pick it up, and swim back. And I got out, and the teacher said, "Oh, we know who the smokers are in this room." And I thought, "You do. No, you don't. So then I decided I would try rowing because we had to do spring sports. Because I started Exeter in January. And it was a boarding school. And you were supposed to learn to get to know all the students there and everything. And within weeks of joining the school, I had all my friends were outside. There were all the kids who hung out. That was what I was like. And so then in the spring, you had to do a sport, and you could choose different sports. And I really didn't like the idea of wearing a uniform and being in a sort of organized team format and everything like that. So I thought, I'll try rowing. You could go out in the barge. Also, rowing at Exeter was on a tidal river. So some days you couldn't row in the afternoon, so you get an afternoon off. Or you'd have to row early in the morning. But the novices didn't really row early in the morning. So I thought, oh, well, I'll try that. And I just never really loved it. I never looked back after that and started training and went to the Olympics. So that's the story.
What grabbed you about this? About rowing?
Well, actually, this is the thing about Concord. There's a lot of people in Concord who are into books and also into boats. And, you know, I think about my family history, which I didn't know anything about at the time. And it makes me kind of wonder. But I really like being out I was doing hiking. I actually done a lot of hiking with a family from Concord. And
with your family? No,
well, my dad and my mom, they took us hiking when we were kids. We would like climb Mount Monadnock. And then when we started skiing at Sugarloaf, we would climb Bigelow Mountain. But I got to be friends with a lady named Jessica Stern, who's from the town of Concord. And her father was, lives in Cambridge now, but he used to hike a lot. And I got to know Jessica, and the father would allow me to come with Jessica, and we would climb in the White Mountains when I was around 13, 14, 15 years old. And we used to go almost every weekend, and I loved being outdoors, and I loved the hiking. And I would go with Jessica and myself and her stepbrother and maybe one of his stepbrother friends, the Fitches. And we would go on these long hikes, and after a bit of chit-chat in the beginning, we would go for like 3 hours, and nobody would say a word. Because we were just like, we knew each other. We just walked. I love that. And rowing kind of, that's the one thing that continued that. I mean, it continued that thing that I started with hiking in the White Mountains. It was, I haven't really done any White Mountain hiking since, but it was wonderful. I mean, that's what really brought me out of all this hanging out with the bad crowd, was this hiking, you know. And rowing just built on that. And I really loved rowing.
You loved being quiet like that in nature, just moving through the quiet?
Well, sometimes, yeah, but it wasn't so totally like that. I mean, let's say we were going down after we had gone up. I mean, especially George Fitch, Doug Plummer, and myself, we used to race down the mountain. We would compete and everything like that. Sometimes we would compete, sometimes we wouldn't. Sometimes we'd go fast, sometimes we'd go slow. So there was a lot of, you know, intensity as well as, you know, sereneness at times. You know, it varied. And then a lot of the times it was when you're going up, your heart rate's up, you're sweating, and you're just marching along and everything. I love that part of it as well. And all of that you see in rowing, you know, you're working really, really hard sometimes you're paddling. But for me also, I am actually quite competitive when it gets down to it, and I love the competition as well. After my first year at Exeter, which is that first term where I did the aquatics, and then I did sort of introductory rowing. After that, I was on the team. After that, and the next 2 years, it was all about me being on the rowing team. I pulled my grades up a lot, I was able to apply to lots of different universities. I got into Princeton University, and I'm really proud of my high school team. We were the second class at my high school that actually had girls rowing. This was at Phillips Exeter. And even though we had, like, the boys had a proper locker room where they had like showers and hooks and lockers and nice lots of wood paneled and everything like that, we just had the janitor's bathroom and cupboard was turned into our station. And the janitor, he was really the boatman. I really liked him. We got on really, 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 really well. And he didn't mind giving the girls his little room, but it was really tiny. And that's where we got to change and everything. But we could change back in the dorms.
His name?
Chan Sandler. And I still have pictures of myself at graduation where I had a picture taken with him. And I think, you know, he goes back to the academy a long time, and he used to, like, take the toboggan with food on it around during the Depression to make sure all the kids got food and everything. And during the war for when there was rationing. But we didn't necessarily have the best coaches either, or the best boats. But we loved what we were doing, and we were really keen to do it. We really tried hard. And when I went off to Princeton, I was on a very strong team where we had three freshmen in the first boat, two older ladies from older classes like sophomore or junior who just started to row that year, and three returning varsity from the prior year. So all these novices, and we were, you know, the varsity boat, and we came third in the Eastern Sprints. And right that year, that would have been 1977, the spring of 1977. That was when I was finishing my freshman year at Princeton. So we were third in the Eastern Sprints. We beat Wisconsin, who was stroked by Cary Graves, who had won a bronze medal in the 1976 Olympic Games. And the Radcliffe crew beat us, and the seventh seat in the Radcliffe crew was my seventh seat from Exeter, Martha Newman. So she had made her mark on rowing as well. So it was really, really exciting days. And we didn't have the best coaches or the best boats. We did get a brand new boat that year at Princeton, and we named the boat, well, I didn't get it, but everybody decided they liked the name of the boat. They liked to name the boat the J'ai faim. And I was a freshman, and I was as hungry as could be, but I didn't equate myself. I didn't see that in myself. I just thought I was a normal person. So I didn't understand why we called the boat the J'ai faim.
Spelled?
J'ai faim, F-A-I-M. That means I'm hungry in French. I just didn't get it. I said, why do we have to call it the J'ai faim? And because back in those days, we were so hungry, but we didn't even know it, is what I'm trying to say. And it was the Yale girls, ladies. At Princeton, we had locker rooms at the back of the tanks. Wasn't that great? The boys had laundry done. I think the ladies could have laundry done as well, but I don't know, you put all your laundry on a pin and it goes in a giant cauldron. You know, I'd just rather jog or walk back to my dorm and have a shower in the dorm. Thank you very much. That wasn't very nice either, but the men had a really big locker room and we didn't. But the men had to walk back up the hill to the campus. And okay, a lot of the guys had cars. I never had a car. I just walked. But it was the women at Yale who had to take a bus ride from New Haven to the boathouse and train while the men trained. And then after the outing was over, they would sit there totally wet and sweaty and cold in the winter in a bus waiting while the Yale men showered. That's why the Yale women protested. You probably heard it was a female athletic director, but they took their clothes off and everything. And Yale built a new boathouse. We named our boat the J'ai faim, but we didn't sort of protest like that. And
tell me more about that. I'm kind of dense. So the J'ai faim, meaning?
I'm hungry. It means I have hunger. That's French for I am hungry.
What kind of hunger are we talking about?
To win, to be the best, to compete on equal terms as the men, to all that kind of stuff. I didn't really think about equal terms of the men. Yeah, they had all these showers and everything and lockers, but that didn't bother me as long as I knew I could be better than them. And I knew I could, so I didn't really care. That's what it's like to be hungry that way, you know? And we didn't complain about the showers. We would have if we were sitting there cold. I'm sorry, that was a recipe for a women's, you know, protest.
So you had a leg up on the Yale students, but still certainly not a sense of equality.
Well, I have to say that they beat us a lot as well. They were a fantastic. They were maybe they had even more hunger than we did.
The Yale
crew when I was at Princeton.
So, what does hunger do for you as a rower?
Well, to be an Olympic athlete, a lot of people think it's kind of sacrifice. I think it's a kind of self-centered kind of being that you become. You have to do everything. I mean, you're basically focused all the time on making sure you don't miss practice, that you do the best you can in practice, that you do all the things you need to do to get where you want to go. And it means, you know, like going to bed early. I mean, and not going to the music concert that your parents want to go, not going to parties. I don't think that's totally right. So I always advise young rowers now that a really good way to loosen up after a really hard practice is to clean your parents' car, especially if you're driving it to practice. That's a great way thing to do. Parents will be happy, and you think about the Karate Kid, you know, wax on, wax off, you know. So you should try to be a part of your family as best you can, because things become self-centered, and it's a really hard balance to maintain. When, you know, you know, you see families that move their whole family because, you know, one child is really good at diving and everybody else suffers. I mean, that didn't happen in my family, but little things do. It was always assumed that I was going to be doing was training. And so you do have to train a lot. But to work, you have to want to do it. You have to want to train.
To be hungry to train.
Yeah, yeah. If you lose that, you know, then why are you doing it? And you're not going to. People talk about attitude, but to have the dream and like every once in a while you think about, wow, you know, I'd really like to do something. And sometimes, like for me, like when I finished Princeton, I'd already been on one Olympic team, the 2008 Olympic team, which was a boycott year. And the team, the actual boat I was on, the women's quad, we might have made the final, but we weren't really medal contenders. And so the fact that there was a boycott didn't really, I mean, it was upsetting for me, but I mean, it wouldn't. That's not what stood in the way of me. That's not what stopped me from getting a medal that year. Is that I wasn't good enough. I knew it. So, yeah, the boycott was terrible. It was really terrible for the boycott. 1980, the U.S. didn't compete in the Olympics because of the Afghanistan war, and certain athletes and in sports across the Olympic piece, across the Olympic team, all the teams that didn't compete. There were some athletes who. It was their only Olympics. It was the only time they were in pole position to win a gold medal. So for some people, it was, you know, they had something really big taken away from them. And those are the people who became what we call, well, they talk about the ghost Olympics, who never, ghost Olympians. They never got to go to another Olympics. They had other things to do. They were at their peak. I know a lady who actually lives in Cambridge, but she coaches a high school team at Acton Boxborough. Her name is Holly Hatton, and she was the coxswain of the women's eight in the 1980 Olympics. And the weight requirement was pretty low for coxswains at the time. And if she'd stuck with it, if she, you know, had the money to not work and just do coxing and stuck with it, then a couple of years later, maybe she would have still been able to make the weight. And maybe she would still be the coxswain of the Olympic team the way the coxswain of the Canadian women's team, Leslie Thompson, she's been coxing the Olympics since 1976. But Holly, she was big for a coxswain, so she struggled to make the weight. And also she only had herself. There wasn't anybody supporting her except herself. She couldn't just keep coxing and not getting paid, you know, not having a job. So she knew she had to go to work after this. So she knew this was her last Olympics, and she didn't get to compete. We did select a team, and her eight, who was coached by the guy named Chris Korzeniowski, who was my, after my second year in, starting my second year in Princeton, Chris Korzeniowski, he's a Polish guy.
Can you spell it?
Korzeniowski. He defected from Poland in the early 1970s, and he went to Italy, coached older senior men in a rowing club in Rome, and then he moved to Canada and coached the Canadian Olympic team in 1976. And in 1977, he interviewed and was selected for, and he was appointed Princeton University women's rowing coach, my coach, for the next 3 years. And Chris very quickly became head coach of the women's. U.S. Olympic women's team, including the 1980 boat with Holly Hatton in it. And I made the quadruple sculls. When we got to the big pre-Olympic competition, which we still competed in, many of the U.S. boats did extremely well. Like the men's eight, the women's eight beat the East Germans, won the gold medal. They felt they were in contention for gold. And so those people really suffered from the 1980 boycott. Whereas in my situation, I mean, I knew I wasn't in the hot boat, so... I got over it pretty quickly.
In a
metal contender boat. You know when you are, you know when you're not.
Talk about that.
Well, I mean, the year before I was in a quad, almost the same quad, and we were were very strong, three very strong single scholars, and also some people good at, one person who was more excellent in, as like a team player. But also two of the rowers, Lisa Hansen and Liz Hills. Now Lisa Stone and Liz O'Leary. Liz is still coaching at Radcliffe. Lisa's now married to Greg Stone, and their daughter Jevy is the medal contender for this upcoming Olympics, Rio. And Jevy's barred my boat in some of the world championships, including the 2012 Olympics. Back in 1979, Lisa and Liz were the defending national championship champions in the women's double, and they lost to another crew in the U.S. trials. So Lisa and Liz, a top, you know, medal winning at the world championship level, they'd won two bronze medals. They won a bronze medal in 1977 in the world championships and also in 1978 in the world championships. The 1978 world championships were held in Karapiro, New Zealand. That was my first world championships. I was the stroke of the eight, and I was in the eight, we came fourth place. I wasn't very happy with our performance. And I knew Chris was laughing because he didn't think we were very good. Chris was a fabulous coach. And he took over the women's eight after that, and they got medals and everything, but I wasn't in the boat. So in 1979, Lisa and Liz lost the trials to an upcoming double. So Lisa and Liz tried out for the quad, and I made the quad with Lisa, Liz, and one other rower named Nancy. Her name was Nancy Parson, and she was a cross-country skier who'd gone to Dartmouth, and she was very, very good on distance, even though we were racing only 1,000 meters, which is a very short race, like 3.5 minutes or less. But we had a really good time of it together as a crew, and we felt like the boat was going really well. And that's the first time I was in a national team crew where I felt that we were really good and we could compete with East Germany, Romania, whoever you throw. We were going to fight for a medal. And we went to Yugoslavia for the World Championships. It was then Yugoslavia. We went to this beautiful lake called Bled, which is now part of Slovenia. Part of Slovenia is the Dalmatian coast, and there's part of it's more alpine. This is the alpine part, and there's this beautiful lake called Bled. And Nancy ate some bad fish, and in those days they gave her IV drip, which is great. I could have used a few IV drips in other incidents, but she got an IV drip. She fully recovered, but in those days the rules said you couldn't, once you used a spare in a race, you couldn't put your other rower back in. And with the spare, we were nowhere. It wasn't her fault. She did the best she could, but she just didn't, you know. So we had made the final. We came in fifth, and I was really disappointed. But I thought, well, the Olympic year, you know, is coming, and I'm good in the single. This fall of 1979, it was 1978, we didn't compete in the head of the Charles, this big fall head race that means a lot to scullers because it's a really big deal to row in the head of the Charles in the single women's single.
I don't even know what the head single of
the,
means.
Oh, the single, okay, a quadruple scull is a boat where four people are rowing. Each person has two oars, so it's symmetrical. So it looks kind of like a water bug, like a really compact water bug. An eight has got eight rowers. Each rower only has one oar. So they're bigger oars. And it's one oar. There's an oar going one direction, then the other direction. So it's more like a centipede. But it's a centipede all rowing together. It's just that one rower is on the right side, then one rower is on the left side. And then you go down the boat that way. Sometimes you put two rowers together, both on the same side, to keep the boat together. Sometimes we have funny ways of rigging boats, but sculling is with two oars, rowing is with one oar. And I started off doing rowing in an eight, and then after I went to New Zealand with stroke of the eight, my coach Chris laughed at me. He said, "Ann, you're too short for making the eight. Why don't you try sculling?" And that's what I started doing. But anyway, I started doing sculling in 1978. And I really liked the sculling. Even though I was on the sweep team, which is big oar, in 1978 in New Zealand for the World Rowing Championships, where Lisa and Liz got the bronze, their second bronze medal. In 1979, I tried out for the quad. Made the quad with Lisa, Liz, and Nancy. Fifth place in the world championships. Then went right into, I think the day after the final, I was out running. 5 mile run, then 6 mile run, then 7 mile run. Then I was doing all my, then I was back at Princeton training, but I was training for the head of the Charles in the single. Because my coach said I could do the head of the Charles in the single instead of one, instead of a big team boat. This was while I was at Princeton. A single is one person, a solo in the boat. You are out there. It's like being on that mountain all alone, in silence, just going on as hard as you can or, you know, as long as you can. I just loved it. And I rode the single in the head of the Charles in 1979. It was my first head of the Charles in the single. And
head of the Charles.
Head of the Charles is a head race. So a lot of the races for like the World Championships up until 1984 were held over 1,000 meters. It takes about 3 minutes in an eight, 3.5 minutes in a, or less in a quad, about 3 minutes and 40 seconds or less, or maybe a little more depending on the wind in a single. That's a sprint. I mean, that's not a distance event. It's like maybe something in between the 800 meters and the 1,000 and the 1,500 meters for track and field. And if in track and field, if you know anything about track and field, there are 800 meters runners who are distance runners who are like 1500 mid-distance runners who are sharpening up for something quick, or 400 meter runners who are sprinters who are going for something a little bit longer, 800, you know, less than 2 minutes. Rowing in 4 minutes, I'm only just starting. I mean, that's what's great about the head of the Charles. It's 5 miles. So it's 5 miles rowing. And it's in the single, and I got accepted in the singles entry. There are about 25 entries in the women's championship single in the head of the Charles. And the lineup is based on the prior year, which I hadn't done. So the winner from the prior year gets to go off first. It's one by one. It's race against the clock. So we had a pretty good team of a pretty good group of scholars in those years. And I think a lot of the top scholars had been on the three of the top scholars, Lisa Hansen, Liz Hills, and Joan Lind, who was the top scholar of the day. She was the silver medalist from Montreal Olympics. They hadn't been able to compete in the 1978 head of the Charles because we were all in New Zealand. So everybody who stayed home, including Nancy. In fact, it was Nancy Parsonen who won the head of the Charles that in 1978.
Nancy
so she got
Parsonen?
To Parsonen, who was in my Parsonen, P-A-R-S-I-N-E-N. Now her name is Nancy Vespoli, V-E-S-P-O-L-I. Nancy Vespoli's husband, Mike Vespoli, runs the Vespoli boat making company. They make rowing shells. But back then she was Nancy Parsonen, and she had won the head of the Charles in 1978. So she got to start first. And then somebody must have seeded some of the rowers because some of the, like the top rowers, they weren't going to put them all the way in the end. So they put like Lisa Hansen, Joan Lind, Lisa Hansen, now Stone, Liz O'Leary, Liz Hills, now O'Leary, so on down the line. And then at the very end, they put me and then a bunch of club other scholars. So I was way in the back, like I was this novice, you know. They put me back there and I thought, that is a stupid thing to do. I have to pass all these people. And I passed and passed and passed. I kept passing in this race. You know, it's the head of the Charles. It starts at the BU boathouse. And it goes under some railroad bridges. And there's a big sign saying, go BU and stuff like that. And then it goes through two bridges. I can't remember the names, but it's where... It's kind of near the Citco sign. It's near the Genzyme building, and it's a straightaway. It's a 1,000-meter straightaway. You go around past the Riverside Boat Club, and you have these two bridges to go through. And when you come through the two bridges, then you've got the bend where you've got the Weld Boathouse here on the right hand on one side of the river, the Harvard Boathouse on the other, and I think you've got the Weeks Bridge going. Across, and you have to, it's really hard to get that angle right, and you have to know what you're, you know, everybody told me all these rules about steering, But I figured once you got to a certain point, you just had to steer on the in. You had to steer. It seemed like you were rowing into the middle of the river, but that if you did that, you would get a better time. So I was doing that, and I'm starting to pass people, and I started noticing how I was passing. I was passing, you know, I was passing Liz Hills. I passed Liz Hills. Oh my God! I passed somebody. Oh, then I passed Lisa Hansen, and then Lisa said, "Go, Anne." I'm like, I passed Lisa Hansen. You know, she was one of the, she was a bronze medalist in the world championships.
She said, go Anne.
And she said, go Anne when I passed her. And I didn't manage, so I got to the end of the race and I passed quite a lot of people, but I hadn't passed Joan Lynn and she beat me, but I came second. And that was like, at that point, that was my greatest rowing experience. Prior to that, that year was a great year for me because I had gone to national championships in June on 1,000 meters and I had won the intermediate single. And the people I raced in the intermediate single are like, you know, great rowers like Chris Ernst, the very small girl from Yale. There was a book written about her by called A Daisy for Chris, and it was written by Mary Mazzio. And she's become a plumber. She went to Yale, and she was in the bow of the 1976 Olympic women's eight, and she got a bronze medal. She's about 5'4", same size as my daughter. And she was in that race as a novice sculler. Carly Gear was in that race as a novice sculler, silver medal in the women's single in the 1984 Olympics. One of the top, a lady who became one of the top Canadian lightweight Olympic rowers was in that race. And I was in the race, and I won that race, the intermediate single. Then I got a gold medal at the National Sports Festival. It's a bit of a joke, but I got a gold medal there. And then the best thing was the head of the Charles getting the silver medal, second place behind Joan Lynn. And that set me up for going into 1979, going in the singles trials, coming third, then getting selected to the team, having this fantastic quad. And then in 1980... I was training with Chris Korzenowski, was kind of coaching me, but I was left a lot to my own devices. I did a lot of training. My technique wasn't that great. I think I finished third in the singles trials, or maybe fourth. And then I started to row a double with Lisa Hansen to train for the double. And Lisa and I thought she had chosen me over Liz, which I thought was really hard for Liz, but I said yes, and then the boycott came. The boycott announcement, a final boycott announcement came, and Lisa and her boyfriend Greg Stone decided that they would honor the boycott. That's how they felt. They had every right to do that, and they left the training camp. So I had no longer had Lisa to row with. So I was asked to row with it in the double with another lady, who, you know, we were good, but we weren't the best. We came third in the doubles trials. And then the both of us made the quad, but once we were in this quadruple sculls, you know, the four, each rower has two oars, so you're rowing them, you know, but it was very symmetric. We were in this boat that I knew we weren't going to win a medal. So, like I said, I passed the boycott, it happened, I carried on, I was already training for the next Olympics.
Talk about that boycott, and how were people making these decisions?
It was about Afghanistan, and it was about the Russian invasion of Afghanistan. And I mean, I respect Jimmy Carter now as one of the presidents that had one of the strongest set of ethics as a president and as an individual after he left the White House. And he also is quite amazing because he took one of those new immunotherapies and he survived brain cancer. So. You know, he's still there. Everybody was waiting for him to go, and he's still around. What a guy. And I didn't agree with the boycott. I thought we should still compete, and I thought it was wrong to put politics, ahead of the Olympics. I felt really bad about the boycott. But like I said, for me, I wanted to win in the Olympics, and that was not going to be my Olympics. So it really went over my head in terms of the emotional impact. For people like Holly, who were in the eight, she was coxswain of that eight. She was never going to coxswain an Olympic team again. She did go to the Olympics as a coach, but that was her chance to win a medal, and that was her chance to to win a medal that she was prepared to win. She was, you know, she was ready to take that boat and help them over the line and get that gold medal. So for those people, it was really a big deal. And it's really interesting that we don't really have that many Olympic reunions, because a lot of people, if you're on the Olympic team, you don't get a medal, you know.
I'm starting to hear a buzz. This is...
So we left off where there's this boycott, but it wasn't your time to win an Olympic medal. So you're going on. Where does that put you next?
So after the 1980 sort of boycott year, I was in a situation where I still had a year of university. So I went right back to university. I had Chris Korzenowski as my coach. We had a great year, and he told me that my heart wasn't in the eight. I just wanted to do the single. He was probably right, because I was trying to do both. And I didn't have the great head of the Charles in 1980. It had been a long year, and I had a slight injury. But I also should say that in sculling, the top sculler, Joan, she was at the time she was Joan Van Blum. The boycott must have been really hard for her, back to the boycott. She had taken a year off of her school teaching, so she was in really good shape for the 1980 Olympics. And she probably felt that even though she'd come in fourth place the year before, that she was going to do really well in the Olympics. She'd got the silver in 76, and there she was in 80 again. So it looked like that was it for her. So all the other scholars, except for Lisa Hansen, kept going. Although Liz O'Leary went to sweep. Good move. She got a bunch of medals in the eight, in the women's eight, rowing in the women's eight as a sweeper, having switched from sculling, which she was quite tall. So off I went doing the sculling. And in 1981, I actually was able to win the singles trials for the first time ever. The single was the second boat chosen. So the U.S. team prioritized the double. And this is my first... I'm starting to get the hang of the U.S. Rowing Federation. So the way that what they just did was they decided that because we had a very, very strong double, which is true, in 2080, the Greer sisters, Judy and Carly Greer, the Women's Rowing Committee or something like that, decided that they would have the doubles trials first so that Judy and Carly could beat everybody or race against any contenders. And that they should prioritize this boat, because after all, we had a good chance of getting a medal in this boat. Great decision. And then everybody else who didn't go to the double could then try out for a quad. Well, I didn't want to try out for the quad. It was there were a lot of new rowers coming in. So I only went to the singles trials. And I won the singles trials, and I think I came in eighth in the world championships. I was really dozy on the start, and I completely missed my chance to make it into the final. And I also it was kind of it was the start of me wondering kind of where the leadership was, because this was my first year in the single. I was quite a strong sculler, but you know, still had a lot of faults, and needed a coach, and there wasn't anybody there to coach me. I didn't really have a coach for the world championships, so the coach of the double said he would coach me. Now, he had been coaching the double in the Olympics and that year, and they were used to him, so they responded to him. You know, when he told me to do something, it didn't make any sense. Nothing he told me made it. It's not that he's a bad coach. He just wasn't tuned in to me. And I needed a coach where I would be the A number one priority. I didn't get that in 1981. I still wanted to do the single. So in 1981, I graduated from Princeton, and I turned down all my job offers. I turned down all my business school offers and went to Boston and got a job in a sports store and started training for the Olympics. And I didn't want to train on the Charles River with all my oppo. And I had lots of oppo. They were all, a lot of them were training in Boston on the opposition. So, because I had Chris as a coach. I had Chris Korzenowski as my university's coach. So that means when I went from Chris Korzenowski, university coach, to somebody else, national team coach, they weren't as good as he was. And I felt disappointed that I didn't have somebody as good as Chris. And they weren't necessarily bad coaches, except Chris was a good coach for me. He taught me about training, about interval training, about long-distance training, about the feeling of the boat in a way that other coaches just, the next set of coaches I had, the one in 1979 was pretty good, but not as good as Chris. And in 1981, this guy who was coaching me sort of temporarily in the single, that didn't go over very well. In 1982, I didn't have a coach at all. But I love training, and I moved back in with my parents and worked part-time, did a lot of training, and one thing led to another, and I started doing 10-kilometer road racing to try and be fit because fitness was really important in rowing, and sometimes when you go out in the row, if it's on the water, it's rough, or if it's a team boat, it's not really rowing very well, you don't get such a good workout. But if you run hills or do a 10K race at like a close to 6 minute, I couldn't quite do 6 minute, but I could do like a 6:20 pace. That is pretty good. You will get fit. I had started doing that, and I met ladies from Liberty Athletic Club, which is a local running club with a lot of Concord members. And I joined that running club in 1982 while I was working in the sports shop. And the other thing I did was I went to a small long-distance competition, like the Head of the Charles, but smaller. One was on the Merrimack. It was called the Head of the Merrimack in near Lowell. And I saw that there was a rowing, a small boathouse in an old garage there. And they let me. And I moved my boat from Boston to Lowell. So I rowed on the Merrimack River. It was wonderful. And I would just go out there by myself. And I liked training by myself. I didn't want to train with other people who just wanted to do 500-meter pieces all the time, because that wasn't the right training. So I wanted to do the right training. And I did find a coach. I found a coach, a Canadian guy. It was okay, and it was helpful because he really gave me a very high workload. So I did track training. And in the beginning, I did the track training in the spring of 1992, after the winter I'd done the 10K racing. But then when I started doing the track, when I first went there, they were doing track training on a track at the Middlesex Vocational School. There's a track there. Liberty Athletic Club used to train there. And I was kind of a duck out of water. I mean, okay, you know, I was a rower. I was kind of, you know, chunky, you know, big. They said, oh, yeah, we remember you from the 10K race. You are a pretty fast 10K racer, but what are you going to do on the track? I said, well, I want to get faster on the start. They said, well, why don't you join the teenagers in their sprint practice? And these are young girls, like 12, 13-year-old girls. And they giggle all the time. So I was spent a lot of time laughing. And that's great. It's really good for you. And I loved it. I did these sprint, and I was, you know, pretty behind them. And then one day, the older ladies, some of them were pretty good runners. They said, well, why don't you do, there's no junior today. Why don't you do 400 meters? Why don't you do the quarter miles with us? And I was like 5 seconds behind on every quarter. And finally, we did a few. And then the coach, John Babington, said, Ann, why don't you push, because he thought I was actually getting better. He said, why don't you really push on this one? So I pushed really hard, and I did a quarter in 70 seconds. I've never done that again in my life. He said, yeah, you better do that some more. I said, that just about killed me. But they let me start training with the older ladies, but I really love training with the girls, the younger kids. There was a ladies rowing training club, and that summer in 1982, I won the 500-meter sprint at the national championships in the women's single. And it was that sprinting training with the kids, that it was the teenage girls that did it. And
where was that?
The national championships were somewhere in New York State somewhere. This was all took place on the track at, you know, at Minuteman Vocational School. And I lived my parents' house in Concord. And I think that year in 1982, I think I came second in the Head of the Charles, even though my time tied for first. But because Judy had done better the year before, she got to come first and I got to come second. But that was fun. I got a lot of seconds and thirds in the Head of the Charles those days. 1983, same thing. I got second behind somebody who's really fast named Ginny Gilder. And in let's go back to 1982. So 1982, I did really well in the single. I came second in the national championships and then third in the trials. But I didn't win the trials, so I didn't get to go in the single to the world championships in 1982. And I didn't go in the double either. But I made the quad. And the quad had myself from Concord, Massachusetts, had Ginny Gilder from New York City, who went to Yale, had Carly Gear, who went to Dartmouth, and Ann Strayer, who went to Princeton. And I think we came in fourth. We were a pretty good crew. We had a coxswain named Chris something. And we were fourth place in the world championships. And that was in 1982. That's when in the fall, the head of the trials, Carly Gear, who had been in the double, she'd been in the single in 1982. I get all mixed up. She'd been in the single in 1982. And I ended up being second in the head of the trials in 1982 behind Judy. Then in 1983, things went really differently for me. So in 1983, also, I was very strong in the single. And we had seat racing. So seat racing is when you take two boats and you with either two or four rowers in them, and you race them side by side. Look at look and measure the distance at the end of the piece, say a three-minute piece. So boat A beats boat B by three lengths. Then you take two people, a person from boat A and a person from boat B, and swap them and race them again. And then you can measure how much better the two people who got swapped are. So we had these seat racing and quadruple sculls on the Connecticut River in Hanover, New Hampshire. And I lost a lot of my seat races, and I knew I wasn't going to make the quad. And the quad was named without me. And I told my parents, they were pretty upset. But I said, I lost all the seat races, so it was very fair. So I'm going to try for the double. So they started the double selection. The double selection wasn't a trials that year. It was a selection by they would just choose the double from the camp, or these camps. We weren't sponsored athletes. We would just pay for our own ourselves all year long and train on our own or with clubs with occasional visit from the national team coach. And then we would go to this sort of four-week-long training camp at Dartmouth University, staying in people's homes, ahead of the world championships. Often we didn't get to go to early competitions to find out how good we were against the top boats. We didn't even, we just trained and went to the world championships. It was kind of sad. But it was at this camp, and the coaches, Tom McKibben and John Van Blum, decided that they had selected the quad, but then they would hold the doubles racing. But I also think, now I understand what they did as well. They thought that maybe they would look for other double combinations as well. Maybe they would look for someone from the quad if they saw a really good doubles combination. I don't know. Maybe they did, maybe they didn't. I really don't know. To this day, I don't know. But they involved the people from the quad, the women who had already been named to the quadruple sculls, those four women. Some of them competed in the selection trials for the double. I guess it's also maybe to have let's say you have three doubles. You have a double from the quad who's there to get the racing, to make them work hard and train hard. And then two doubles who are contenders for the double. So we had three doubles across, or maybe even four, because you had the two doubles from the quad and then two doubles trying to make the quad. And it seemed to me that we went out to practice for 2 weeks in a row every day, and every day they tried to get a combination where my boat wouldn't come first. And my boat came first almost every time, even against the quad, the ladies in the quad, who were already selected, who were, had beat me in the seat races. But a double is a lot different than a quadruple scull. It's two people. And I had never really raced a double very much, but I was pretty good. And after about 2 weeks, they came up to me and they said, well, we're sorry to say that we have to name you to the team. I said, well, I'm sorry too. I don't know what I said. They said, we want you to row with Robin. And I said, well, didn't really have any choice. I said, oh, okay, let's go, And
so I don't get it. Are they giving you a compliment and you're joining the team, or why sorry?
Because I didn't want me to, on the team.
It's so strange.
They said, There are three key characters in this, so besides me. One is Monica, Monica's passed away a couple years ago of brain cancer, and she became one of my best friends, and we rode a lot together after that. But that time we had never really rode together. Monica's 6 foot tall, and she was a runner-up Heisman Trophy winner in basketball, and she was a very strong rower, but she was very injury-prone. And she didn't really do much training, but naturally she was just a totally gifted athlete and could do very well in races. I never understood that. And it wasn't until years later that I really understood that.
That she was gifted rather than a trainer?
Yeah, because I tried to get her to train with me. It didn't work. And it was my mistake. I could have still rowed together with her if I had figured out how to row with her, how to row. I couldn't, if I had done her training program, I just need to do training on my own. I could just train with Monica and do extra workouts on my own, right? Where was the guidance to tell me that? Nobody told me that. I learned it myself the hard way. But, so Monica had teamed up with this other lady named Robin. And when I was in the four-man sculling boat, the quadruple sculls in 1982, Robin and Monica, two really new, relatively, their first year on the team, fourth place in the world championships in the double. Beautiful boat, looked great together. And the coaches really wanted this combination to come together again, and we're pushing that for the Olympics. But so in 1983, the year before the Olympics, Monica was very injured and wasn't really in contention. And there was a newcomer named Beth. And her name was Beth Holosik. She was about 5'10", very, very strong, like she could probably clean like 40 pounds more than I could. You know, so you got the bar on the floor and you whip it up, catch it on your shoulders. She could clean it, you know, a lot more than I could. She could, you know, if you jump from a standstill to see how high off the ground you could jump, she could probably jump up to here. I could probably jump like this. I just don't have that strength. I'm much more an endurance person. So obviously she should be in the boat. You know, she should be in the boat with Robin. And that's what they wanted. They wanted Beth with Robin. And to this day, I feel that the mistake they made was not putting Beth in the boat with me. But I don't think Beth ever reached her full potential. And I think when she was with me, that really worked. But the thing is, whoever they put with me, I was trying to make it work, to make the team and everything that year. So off I went with Robin. And Robin was this beautiful technician. So they put me and Robin together, and at this point, I was having trouble sleeping. I had had nightmares because I felt like I was being persecuted. And when they told me I'd made the team, I mean, I was very relieved. And if the first row we went out with Robin, you know, I was exhausted. So I was paddling with Robin, and they said it would be a light row, you know. So we came back in off the water, and there was a big barbecue. Everybody was having this barbecue, and the coaches came up to me. They said, "We need to talk to you." I said, "Oh, okay." They came up to me, and they said, "Well, we've changed our minds. You're not on the team." And this was the year before the Olympics. So this is like my world falling apart. So I was really upset, and they said, "Well, you can come as a spare." I said, "Well, I'm not going to go as a spare." And they said, "Well, you can go to the Pan American Games." It was also the year of the Pan American Games, I have to say. "You can go to the Pan American Games with Cindy." And I said, "Well, I'm not going to go to the Pan American Games with Cindy." So I didn't think about whether I could go to the Pan American Games in the single, but they said, I can't remember, they might have offered that, I don't remember that coming into it. They said, I said, "Could I go with Monica?" They said, "Well, Monica's injured." And I said, "Well, I'd rather with an injured Monica than with any of those other people you mentioned, except for Beth." But Beth was with Robin. They said Beth is going to go with Robin, not me. And I didn't say, "Why don't you put Beth and me in the boat?" which was what they should have done. And Beth and Robin went to the World Championships, and they came. There's a six boat. A final, there's a six boat B final, and then there's the C final. They made the C final. Monica and I, I should go back. So that was the big barbecue. They told me I was wrong with Monica. So we started training again, and then they coaches decided that it would be fine for me and Monica to train against Robin and Beth, you know, give them some competition. So with the first practice, we went out, and Monica and I were pretty challenged, and we didn't do very well for our first couple of pieces. But after a while, maybe it was a slightly longer piece, something just clicked, and I said something to Monica. Usually, you know, when somebody says to you, oh, Anne, let's get our act together, let's do this, let's do that, it doesn't work. But something happened, and we beat the other crew, and then we started beating them. And then we started to really beat them all the time. And then one day, the coaches didn't say anything to us. They just had these practices. And one day, we're out in the Connecticut River in the really wide part in New Hampshire, near Dartmouth, as we were at Dartmouth. And they said, okay, we're going to do this piece. And Monica and I went off this way. Beth and Robin went off that way. So we didn't know where we were. They went off that way. We didn't know what was going on. We didn't know who was winning, who was losing. We couldn't tell. We didn't know what the piece was all about. When it was over, they said, oh, that was a selection race. Beth and Robin won. So we thought, oh, okay, you know. We didn't know we were in control. We were thinking to ourselves, come on, they've got to change their mind. This is ridiculous. Everybody in the camp was saying that. They were saying, how come they're doing this? And so Monica and I went off to the Pan American Games, and we did have a coach. We had a coach who was this lady named Joan Lind, who was the silver medalist from the Montreal Olympics in the single. Fantastic rower, my total idol. I was so afraid to even be in the same room with her. I totally idolized her, and I was just so awestruck to be around her. I had never mustered up the ability to have a conversation with her, even though I was on the team with her in 78, the Carapiro New Zealand trip, 79, the Yugoslavia trip, 1980, the boycott year, we were on the team. We at least competed in some regattas. And then 1981, I didn't see much of her. And then 1982, I didn't see much of her. But 1983, she was my coach. She coached me and Monica in the Pan American Games. We won a gold medal. We didn't have that much competition, but we were pretty fast. And we got to know Joan, and it was great. And so I felt a lot better about, you know, going back and trying to make the team, even though I had been cut. And those very same coaches, John and Tom, were appointed as Olympic coach. And you know, people say, "Why don't you go to the wash-up meeting?" They have these meetings afterwards. And
what'd you call it?
A wash-up meeting. Well, I learned that from my husband is a rowing coach, a British rowing coach. He's retired now, but he still does coach accreditation. He was a school teacher. He taught chemistry and computing, and he coached schoolboy rowing for many years, including the British junior team. And every year there was a junior world championships. Afterwards, in the fall, there would be a wash-up meeting. But in the U.S., you know, athletes can go to these things. And people say, why don't you go and tell your story and tell, you know, say that, you know, that John and Tom should be held to, you know, to answer for what happened. But, you know, it's the Olympic year, and if they weren't going to coach, who was going to coach? So I didn't do anything. And I just went to their training camp in in January 1980. I went to L.A., Long Beach, California, to be in their training camp for the 1984 Olympics. And even though they had cut me before, well, they had cut me the year before, so I thought, okay, I'll just, you know, I'll try to be a real team player and get the feeling of how they want to row the quad or row the whatever. So I have a chance of, you know, of making the team. And the order of preference would be the singles trials, then a quadruple skulls selection, and then after that, the double. So I really wanted to make the quadruple skulls so I'd make the team. One of the things I really regret was I didn't tell the coaches that I wanted to row with Monica again. I wanted to make the team, and I wanted to make the team in the single. I was very strong in the single. The coach, John Van Blum, wanted Joan, who by then was his wife, who was one of the top scholars in the U.S., and she wanted to be in the single too, but in practice I beat her a lot.
Your former coach?
Yeah, she was coming out again. She had decided to train again. And that happens. And she'd only coached me just for one race. I mean, she wasn't really my coach. You know, she was my coach for that race. She was like, you know, looking after us for the race, you know, checking everything and all that kind of stuff. But, I mean, you know, she respected me too. And so when it wasn't like she was totally coaching me. It was like she was sharing her ideas about training and rowing with me, somebody she respected, and we got to be friends that way. And we were doing a lot of training, and I was obviously very strong, winning a lot of the seat races, winning a lot of the, we were training in singles. I was winning most of the races we did there, like 500 meters or 2,000 meters. On the 400 meters, I wasn't as good. There were other people who usually were winning. But I would often win a lot of, at least, you know, more than half of the 500-meter pieces I could win. And I knew I was really good. John had Joan and I, everybody else participated except for one lady who was really smart, said she was too tired to do this. I think it was either 2 or 3 weeks before the Olympic trials. John had Joan and I do 3 times 10 minutes racing each other side by side. Of course, neither of us won the singles trials. So, but we were doing whatever we were told. We wanted to make the team. And she was married to the guy, and she was going to do it. So we did it. And the other thing is that if Joan was going to do the 10 minutes, I was going to do the 10 minutes. And if she was going to go this fast, I was going to go faster. You know, we couldn't help ourselves. So we ended up in the quad in the 1984 Olympics, where we won a silver medal in the LA Olympics, which were held at Lake Casitas in California. We were coached by John Van Blum. We had a very strong group of rowers in the boat. We had Joan, by this time she's naming, your name is Joan Van Blum. We had Joan Van Blum, who's one of the top scullers ever in the United States, silver medal in the 1976 Olympics in the women's single, and in this team. And we had Ginny Gilder, who was from Yale, who was bronze medal in the women's single in the 1983 World Championships. That's when I got the gold in the Pan American Games. And this lady named Lisa Rohde, who's very, very strong, very, very strong athlete. And we were coxswained by a lady from the Slack Rowing Club in San Diego, whose cousin had coxed the 1976 women's Olympic eight, coached by Harry Parker, that got the bronze medal. Kelly was a bit younger then, and she was so awestruck by the idea of being a coxswain that she went on to become a coxswain herself, and she was our coxswain in 1984. We were a very strong crew, very fine single scullers. We came second in the competition. I think that individually we stacked up better than any other quad, and I think the Romanian quad that beat us had a higher sum of the parts than we were. We were four really, really, really strong rowers, and I personally think we should have been able to win the gold. I kind of wish the race was over 2,000 meters because we were really good distance athletes. And what's great is that, you know, even though it was Joan's last Olympics, it was Kelly's last Olympics, Lisa's last Olympics, and Ginny's last Olympics, it wasn't my last Olympics. The following year, the distance changed from 1,000 meters to 2,000 meters. The decision wasn't made right away, and by that time I had gone back to business school. I didn't want to go back on the Charles in case I was going to stop rowing. I didn't want to do 1,000 meters anymore. So I didn't want to be on the Charles like MIT. I'd gotten into MIT. I didn't want to go there, and I didn't want to go to the University of Pennsylvania. There's a lot of rowing there as well. I could have gone to either of those business schools. And I wanted to do something different. And also, just reflecting on what's happening now, I remember thinking to myself, you know, here I am, economics graduate from Princeton University, and I've only ever really worked in a sports shop or been a waitress at PJ's Pancake House at Princeton, and I've done a lot of rowing. I want to go into, economics and all the jobs that are looking like, you know, finance and banking and everything. I thought, you know, if you're in finance and banking, you're not actually making something. You're just kind of, you know, pushing things along. You're not actually doing something constructive. How can I do that? And I thought, well, why am I doing this? But then I thought, okay, well, I'm doing it. You know, I got a degree in economics. I got to carry on. You know, so after the 1985 Olympics, also I felt the amount of nationalism about how many gold medals the Americans had won was a little misplaced because that, for me, you know, as much as that there was a great team experience and a fantastic accomplishment to get a silver medal in the Olympics, the top teams weren't really there. East Germany wasn't there. Russia wasn't there. China wasn't there. And in my event, and Bulgaria also wasn't there, certainly Russia and East Germany were the top teams in the women's quad. And some of the other ones, like Bulgaria, weren't that far behind. So not having those crews there, you know, was a little bit of a took a little bit of the shine off. And I took the decision to go to business school in France, because I'd applied to a business school in France as well. So in 1985, off I went to make my fortune. And I had gone on a trip after the Olympics back to New Zealand. My father grew up in New Zealand. Even though his grandfather, who was the grandson of Captain William Skitty, had lost his wife, my father's mother, in 1933 or 1934, when my dad was born in 1931. My dad was about four, and he has a younger brother and an older brother, and they were packed off to New Zealand to live with their grandmother on a sheep station. So when we went to New Zealand for my first World Rowing Championships in 1978, I visited the sheep station. By then, my uncle, who used to live at Nurse Mac Hill in Bedford, in Concord — I don't know if you know Concord, but Nurse Mac Hill is the tallest hill in Concord. My daughter Rachel was running hills there this morning. My Uncle Peter used to live there. He was my father's younger brother. They all grew up in New Zealand. Uncle Peter moved back to New Zealand in 1975. 1978, World Rowing Championships, half the U.S. team went down to his sheep station, had a whale of a time. And so I went back to New Zealand again in 1984, and to get a, you know, just to have a little break. But when I came back, then in November, I went off to, at the end of November, right after Thanksgiving, I went off to France, and I went to business school in France. I went to this place called INSEAD, Institute European of Business Administration, in French, INSEAD. Anyway, it's one of the top European business schools. I'd known about it because one of the professors had stayed at our house, and so I knew about it. I was accepted there. And I arrived there in November. It was only a one-year business school, and you could start in September and finish in May, or you could start in January and finish in December. So I took the January to December. But because I said I didn't speak enough French, I had to go a month early. I think they were trying to sell their French course. Anyway, I arrived in Fontainebleau with my oars. I didn't know if I was going to keep rowing, but I bought my oars just in case. And I arrived in Fontainebleau in late November 1985. And I went to live with the professor for a little while I looked for a place to live. And I started taking the French course. And the first day I was there, I got lost in the Forêt de Fontainebleau running, because I was doing my running, because I was still training. I was doing my running training. I got lost in the Forêt de Fontainebleau. And the second day, I went a different direction down to the bottom of the hill. It's on a long sloping hill. At the bottom of the hill is the town of Fontainebleau, and then there's a town of Avon. At the bottom of the hill, this long slope, there's the Seine, and I found the boathouse. Didn't find anybody, I found the boathouse, though. So I knew where the boathouse was, and I knew where the Forêt de Fontainebleau was. And then I started my French course, found an apartment, a really small apartment, 12 rue de la Paroisse, right next to the market square in the town. Tiny little apartment. It was like 120 francs a month rent. I mean, that's like, you know, $20 or something in today's money. And the people I was staying with, the professor, the wife, didn't really like me being there. So I got out of there as quick as I could. And I moved, that gave me a great incentive to find the apartment. But she did me a favor. She told me about the club d'athlétisme. That's the track club. So I joined the track club. And they also told me where to find the rowing club people. So I found the rowing club people. And by that time, I heard that the distance for women's rowing changed, because, you know, the guys got to race 2,000 meters, which is about a 7 to 8 minute race in the women's single. It's about a six to six and a half minute race in a lot of other women's boats, like the eight or the quad. 1,000 meters in a fast women's eight is around 3 minutes, and you know it's a bit. The boat's only just getting going, as far as I'm concerned. So the race distance was changed to 2,000 meters. So my intentions changed a lot. I really wanted to do rowing and as well as business school. So I started training with the track club and learned about, like, instead of doing your distance running on the pavement, they said don't run on the pavement. Run in the Forêt de Fontainebleau, where on the softer trails. It'll be better for you. And they said, then when we did track practice, because I had done a lot of track practice with Liberty Athletic Club. When I did track practice with the Fontainebleau track coaches, who were French national team track coaches, I didn't know it at the time, but they kind of knew what they were doing. They said I should do the intervals on the grass. They call it les pelouses, on the inside of the track, because it would be better for, you know, I wouldn't get sore legs or something. I don't know. So we learned a lot from them. Then we did a lot of really interesting exercises inside in the stadium, in the gym. It was quite small. Had these really small bleachers. I was used to running Harvard Stadiums. Harvard Stadium, you run up. It takes a long time to get eat. You go, you run up as fast as you can to the top, jog down, move a set of bleachers. You do that's called a stadium. You can do that for a couple hours and you're toast. This is completely different. This is only a couple of steps. And I thought, well, where's the workout? And they said, and I started running up. They said, no. You have to stand totally still. Don't bend your feet. Don't bend your knees. You have to stand upright. Don't bend your knees. And you have to jump anyway. That's really hard to do. It's very explosive. You have to jump without springing, without using your knees. So you have to use other muscles in your body that you never dreamed you had. So I was doing that all the time. Track.
New track.
Oh, new track.